This is the DLR Cast, the essential podcast for fans of Diamond David Lee Roth.
All right, welcome to the premiere of the DLR Cast, the podcast by and for fans of the mighty David Lee Roth. I'm Steve, and with me is my good friend and fellow DLR fan, Darren Paltrowitz. How you doing, Darren?
Great, because you just called me a good friend. That means I elevated in your world, Steve, so not a bad day. What about you?
I'm awesome, and I'm psyched to do this. So just some background, you know, we're starting this podcast because despite being a press magnum of 40 years, you and I both think that just too little attention has been paid to Diamond Dave's musical contributions, particularly his solo work. And we've had so many conversations about this. I know it's always been interesting to me, and I think we can have a lot of fun with this podcast. And I guess to start, let's go back in the time machine. How did you become a David Lee Roth solo fan? How did you become a fan of the man?
Wow, this is going to be a 20-minute story that I'm going to condense really short here. When growing up on Long Island, New York, you're also a Long Islander by nature. You go to a lot of bar mitzvahs, even if you're not Jewish. And my brother's bar mitzvah, they had one of these things called mock rock, which copyright would make it illegal, but you kind of lip sync to some music videos, and then afterwards you got a dub of it and took the tape home. And this is in the late 80s. I remember seeing one or two people lip sync to Jump. And, you know, I was probably 5-6 years old and kind of like, what's that? And then before you know it, you hear the song on MTV and VH1 all the time, and you realize, oh, that's a band. And then you get a little older and you go, that's the same band that did this, 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 and this. And then somewhere along the way, the Gigolo video happened, and the rest is kind of history.
I love that. Yeah, for me it was somewhat similar too. It wasn't related to a bar mitzvah, but I graduated high school in 85, so right in the midst of a maelstrom of when Dave left Van Halen, which we'll get to shortly. But before that, as I was really discovering rock and roll, you know, late 70s, early 80s, for me, it was about Cheap Trick, Kiss, both very visual bands, and then Van Halen. Even though I never really saw them before, prior to MTV, I saw pictures in magazines and stuff, and I was like, wow, these guys look cool. This, you know, before I ever really knew what a front man was, Dave to me was like the template, right? And oh, yeah. You know, just hearing those screams. And of course, you got to couple it with Eddie's guitar, because to this day, the debut Van Halen album sounds as fresh as it ever did the moment, you know, since the moment it came out. It doesn't sound dated. And there's never been an album opener like Eruption. But, you know, as great as all that was and the sound was, for me, it was this guy who just was having, even in like the most aggressive songs, was having so much fun. And I was always a guy who was, while I will never call myself you know, quite the huge literature buff that Dave might be, his lyrics just were always so much more than the usual TNA stuff that was so prevalent in glam metal and stuff at the time. So here's this guy, and not to mention he's athletic, and mm-hmm. he totally looks the part. And of course, I got to mention this too, we share the same last name. So it kind of and to put it a little bit further, as I often wondered, but have not really investigated, both his father and my father are ophthalmologists, and I wasn't close to my dad growing up. So I really don't know. And we lived bi-coastal, so I don't know all the stories, but as kind of a background, I know there were times my dad would get mail addressed to David to his house, because people found out in interviews and stuff that Dave's dad was an ophthalmologist, and you look it up in California and think, okay, well, this guy has got to be it. So my dad got some interesting pieces of mail years ago, but I digress. I apologize. But, you know, here it comes. I remember when 1984 came out, that and hearing Jump, but then also seeing that video. And this is just, it just appealed to me. The guy's sense of humor, his brashness, reading the interviews, I'm a huge stand-up comedy fan. I grew up in Long Island too. To me, he was this gigantic mix of pro wrestling, Borscht Belt comedian, comic book hero, and rock star, which was everything that appealed to me at that time, and quite frankly, still does.
Right. Same deal here. He is an amalgamation of all my interests that I can't shake no matter how hard I try. And he's got this catalog that people don't realize is there for the most part. People hear Jump and Panama and their cover of You Really Got Me, and they go, that's Van Halen. And maybe they know Just a Gigolo. Maybe they know California Girls. Again, another cover right there. But people don't really dig into Yankee Rose like they should. Yeah, it was in a Grand Theft Auto video game and all that. But I think that there's more Dave solo tracks out there than people realize that they're familiar with.
Oh, absolutely. And like I said at the top, I mean, too little attention's been paid. A lot of it is Dave's fault as well, but too little has been paid. You know, too little attention has been paid to that, to what he's done musically, particularly the solo stuff. And well, we aim to correct that here at the DLR cast.
For sure. And to show my devotion, because admittedly, I'm a late bloomer on the DLR train. My wife and I think the third to last concert that we went to was Dave's Vegas residency earlier this year. We went two nights just to Vegas for that. I don't know if that's sick, sad, or awesome, but we did it.
I think it's awesome. And my last concert pre-COVID was in March, was Dave opening up for Kiss right here in Minnesota. So that wasn't the plan for it to be the last concert, but as it's looking like it's very likely going to be my last concert for this year. It's a hell of a note to end the concert year on, I guess.
Yeah, if I had one big disappointment about Dave's shows in Vegas, it was the same set list both nights, and the only song that we got from Eat 'Em and Smile, which isn't my favorite Roth album, I don't know, but the only song that we got was Tobacco Road from that album both nights.
Yeah, and we will, I know we can dive real deep into Dave's setlist choices, which is one of the reasons why, and this is, God, we have so many episodes out of this, man, but that's another, Dave's setlist choices, I think, are, you know, part of the reason why, you know, when he toured solo, why a lot of the great music he's done as a solo artist hasn't always been brought to light. But let's get back to what became the Eat 'Em and Smile album around that time, because right around that time, you know, Jump comes out, and 1984 came out, came out New Year's Day of 84. There's this, you know, massive tour, virtually, you know, and all the press around it, and virtually every step of the way. Even then, I remember reading the rock magazines that, you know, just how, you know, it was no secret to anybody that Dave and the Van Halen brothers and that band, it was like oil and water mixing. But despite right. that, it was just the most combustible, amazing partnership. So when, you know, Dave did the solo EP, you know, with Just a Gigolo and California Girls, Crazy from the Heat. When that came out right on, New Year's Day, I think right early 1985. So the tour is done for 84. They tour a good portion of the world the entire year. They're done. And Dave comes out with this solo thing, which everybody automatically goes, we knew it. He wants to be a lounge singer. This is his thing. And, you know, automatically there's friction with the Van Halen camp, which in his book, Crazy from the Heat, his version is, I told you guys I was doing this a number of times. Don't be surprised. I don't want to go anywhere. This is just me, you know, having fun. And certainly when that came out, the videos were just, to this day, I still laugh at the videos of Just a Gigolo and California Girls. They were just fun, and they were just such a send up of so many things. But I mean, to me, the music was, I love California Girls because it's a great song, but to me, it was certainly not indicative of anything. You know, at that point, I was still like, yeah, I can't wait for new Van Halen music.
Yeah, I hear you on all those ends and points that you just made. Those two videos from the Crazy from the Heat EP stand up. The Just a Gigolo video, the fact that it starts off with him as the VJ and then it cuts to the video, and the video itself, he sends up Cyndi Lauper, Michael Jackson, Billy Idol. Am I missing any there?
Oh, geez. Yeah, I'm trying to think. I mean, there's, yeah, I think you got most of the highlights there, but it's, yeah, in barely.
Oh, Willie Nelson.
Oh, Willie Nelson. Yes, of course. Of course. Yes, in barely 3 minutes. He's knocking fun at all these cultural touchstones, and just brilliant.
there might be one or two more that we haven't thought of. But plus, he's making fun of the kind of backstage studio thing. He's making fun of the VJs. And then after the video is done, he kind of, you know, wakes up like he's been bored from the whole thing. So he breaks the fourth wall. He gives you a hell of a song. He gives you a lot to look at in that video, to say the very least. It's a big budget video that doesn't seem like it was a big budget video. And then California Girls, which one of those was nominated for all the VMAs? Was it both of those or just California Girls?
I'd have to go back and look. I think it was California Girls, though. But yeah, I'll have to go back and look. Maybe I'll remember to correct that in the show notes. But
post-production, fix it in the mix, just like yes, Dave said.
There you go.
Yeah, so all that, it kind of shines a little bit on Eden Smile. That's Life could have been on the Crazy from the Heat EP. But at the same time, he does give you a little bit of what you would have expected next from Van Halen, right?
A little bit, because, you know, that, well, from when you listen to Crazy from the Heat, it wasn't a radical departure. If you listen to, you know, some of the cover choices, particularly, well, on Diver Down, you know, I mean, just the fun, and, you know, you got Big Bad Bill of Sweet William Now and right, and Happy Trails and stuff. I mean, there was no secret that Dave had always these bigger, more grandiose, you know, designs as far as an entertainment. But at his core, he always was, and I still believe, you know, this hard rocker. And so we fast forward a little bit, and lo and behold, just three months later, and I can remember reading this in the magazines and everything. It was around March of 85, and it was officially announced of April 85. So barely 3 months after Crazy from the Heat comes out, Dave's leaving Van Halen. And I can just remember going, what the heavenly fuck? I mean, I'm like, this. I mean, I'm a senior in high school, and this is like as traumatic as anything for me.
Yeah, that wedding singer scene kind of poked fun at it, where he said something like, take off that shirt before Van Halen breaks up. Yeah. But I think that was your real life experience right there.
Yeah, it truly was, because nobody, if you were a fan, was really surprised. It was your biggest fear, and I guess, and for most Van Halen fans, and you know, so I guess you shouldn't say it was necessarily a huge surprise, but sure, it was a shock, and it was like going through a bad breakup. So it's 85, and if you look what Dave, you know, so much of this, and if you go back and read, I remember reading his bio, Crazy from the Heat, his autobiography, and then, you know, and just, it's been told so many other times. I mean, essentially, Dave left because, not just because he wanted to do other things, because he wanted to do things. The Van Halens were more than happy for a long period, and this has been the highlight of virtually the entire Van Halen brothers' career, unfortunately, long periods of inactivity for, you know, regardless of the reasons why, and that's, there's a whole, you can write books about that, but Dave wanted to do stuff. There was the movie idea, which fell apart. He had apparently a movie ready to go in the can with his manager, Pete Angelus, called Crazy from the Heat. That fell apart. And as it was falling apart, I guess he wants to do rock and roll music. And here it comes. And mind you, this is all in the span of 6 months, which is amazing, right? He finds Greg Bissonette on drums, the amazing Billy Sheehan on bass, and a heretofore mostly unknown. I knew who he was because I bought the Alcatraz album. And I, even though I didn't play guitar at the time, I read the guitar magazines, Steve Vai on guitar. And by the end of the year, end of 85, they're in the studio recording what was to become become Eat 'Em and Smile.
Yeah. Another Long Islander, mind you, Steve Vai.
That's correct. Yes, indeed. It all roads go back to New York and Long Island.
Long Island, Kiss, Judaism. Yes. Hard Rock just keeps going back and back to that. I mean, Joe Satriani is another Long Island hard rock guitarist right there. And a lot of people confuse Satriani and Vai.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of folks will. So, yeah, I mean, and you look back on this with the reminder and the lens that there was no internet, there was no chat rooms. If you're lucky, you got this information via radio interview you heard, or a month later reading. For me, it was Circus, Hit Parader, and Kerrang magazine, and occasionally Rolling Stone. But Rolling Stone barely ever covered the music that I loved the most, which was, you know, unless it was Van Halen for the most part. So I can't remember catching wind about Dave ever going to the studio with these guys, but turn the corner into the new year. And what a lot of people I don't think remember is that Van Halen with Sammy Hagar beat him to the punch. 5150 mm-hmm. came out in March of 86, to which the arguments already began. This is better than anything Van Halen's ever done. Wrong. But, then the next thing was, well, what's Dave going to do next? And I can remember arguments. I can remember reading about, but nobody, I don't recall knowing. I don't want to say I knew at the time. I'm sure I did if I was reading guitar magazines, but I'm sure I knew by that time, by the time the 5150 came out, the first Van Halen record was Sammy Hagar. I'm sure I knew who was in Dave's band, and I know I was looking forward to it.
Yeah, and of course, the lineup of Dave's band would go on to change many, many times. But when they had that attempted reunion of the Eat 'Em and Smile era band, I think it was 4 years ago at that L.A. bowling alley, and it was going to happen, and then the rumor was Dave's going to show up, and the fire marshal shut it down. There was such excitement over a backing band. How many times are bands do you really hear about? Do you hear people going, oh, man, Rod Stewart's 1985 band is going to get back together? You don't hear that. You don't hear that about Robert Plant's band. How many bands do you really hear? You don't hear, oh, man, the Billy Joel Stormfront band is getting back together.
And you know what? You bring up such an excellent point, because for me, that was one of the things that really drove home to me, is that even though it was called David Lee Roth, solo album, David's first solo album, Eat 'Em and Smile, all the pictures you saw in the press, everything you saw was the four of those. They were a band. And that's the only time in his career you've ever seen, even the album after that, Skyscraper, there was no group shots of whoever was in the band. These were four guys, ready to freaking pillage and rock and roll, both on vinyl and on stage. And that, for me, was a big, big, that really hit home for me, because it was, he had obviously these unbelievably, just the creme de la creme of players. But this was, to me, it was a solo project, but this is a band project, and these guys are ready to kill.
Yeah. The more that I think about it from saying it, maybe you could argue, okay, well, this is my favorite Ozzy era, or this is my favorite Alice Cooper era. But if you announced, hey, this is the Alice Cooper band without Alice Cooper hitting the road, I don't think you draw more than 50 people or 100 people. If you put the Eat 'Em and the Smile band on the road with Ralph from why can't I think of it? Steel Panther.
Oh, Steel Panther, yeah.
Atomic Punk, Steel Panther. He was even in LA Guns for a bit. If you put them out with him, I really think you could draw a decent crowd. And even if it wasn't him, if it was Stevie Rochelle from Tough, it was some kind of a brash, in shape, blondish, vibrant frontman.
Right.
You would go, wow, that's Sheehan shredding at the same time as Steve Vai, as Greg Bissonette. I mean, all those guys are still alive. They're all still working. And even when Sheehan was out of the band, and Greg Bissonette's brother who replaced him on bass?
Yeah, Matt Bissonette for the Skyscraper tour. Yep.
That and Brett Tuggle on keyboards. I'd go see that band in a heartbeat.
Oh, absolutely. I would too. And I absolutely would. And I can remember at the time also, for it was such a contradiction, because the press spin at the time was, and this is so much of this was the Van Halen saying it as well, was, Dave quit because he wanted to be a showman and a star, wanted to do all this stuff. But that wasn't really the case. I mean, Dave quit because he obviously wasn't getting along with the guys anymore, but he also wanted to, do different things and get super creative and just basically keep working and do all these different things. And sure, a movie. Yeah, he wanted, that was some of the spin too. He just wants to be a movie star. But I think what took a lot of people by surprise was, again, it was a band effort. And I can remember interviews at that time. Dave always shared the spotlight. He could not talk about these guys enough in promoting the band. And I think you felt that on the record, which we'll talk about. But, and you also saw that, you totally saw it on stage. These guys were not backing guys by any stretch of the imagination.
No, absolutely not. He shared the spotlight. I mean, if he didn't, then Steve I wouldn't have that five neck guitar. Was it a four neck guitar?
No, it was a three neck guitar. The heart guitar.
Yeah, I mean, I was just confusing with our favorite band, Cheap Trick. Rick Nielsen has the five neck guitar. But exactly. If Dave was looking to not have the spotlight on anyone else, he would not let Steve Vai have that guitar. To use a wrestling term, you know, he was putting Steve Vai over as his Eddie Van Halen. And since then, whatever band it is that Roth has had, he's always tried to make that lead guitarist be like his Eddie. He's doing that now with Al Estrada. He did that for a decade or so with Brian Young. I don't know if he really toured with John Five. I think John Five got the Marilyn Manson gig.
But yeah, he never did tour for that DLR band album, unfortunately.
Yeah, but he always has made a big point of naming his people on stage and kind of getting them involved in skits. So, you know, a lot of praise to Dave for that. To anyone who says, oh, it's the Dave show, okay, maybe he does want the spotlight on himself, but I think that he's helped make other people's careers for decades.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if we keep going off, it's so easy to go off on different tangent stuff, but if you remember the Eat 'Em and Smile shows, I mean, one of the giant highlights of that tour, that show, was Steve and Billy Sheehan out there doing that co-solo where they're going back and forth chasing each other across the stage for, you know, 15 minutes. Yeah. And you were mesmerized. A guy who's got ego problems, who doesn't want to share the spotlight, is not going to let his bass player and guitar player do that.
Right. Certain bands you could think of, well, the singer leaves the stage because they have to take insulin, or that's a Poison reference right there.
Oxygen.
Or oxygen, or they're tired, or like Axl Rose, they're doing costume changes or something to that effect. In the case of Dave, yeah, maybe he wanted a little breather, but this is also going, hey, look at these heroes that I got in my band. I have the best band on the planet. And again, I think that he gets a lot of crap unnecessarily for that. I don't remember if he left the stage in Vegas for more than a minute. They didn't really do solos as much, but I think he was talking over the solos, which he's been known to do.
Yeah, he has. Back then, though, Eat 'Em and Smile, he didn't. And I think Dave certainly had something to prove. And whether release schedules, I mean, can you imagine what they both 5150 and Eat 'Em and Smile came out on Warner Brothers, right?
Yeah.
So there's some overlap there. Now, Eat 'Em and Smile was produced by longtime Van Halen producer Ted Templeman. So we saw that, and that wasn't necessarily, and 5150 was produced, if I remember correctly, basically by
Jones?
Eddie, yes, and Mick Jones of Foreigner. And I remember not being surprised by that at all, because so much of the press and then everything after that from 1984, around 1984, and so much after that too, right after, and certainly since then, was the fact that Ted Templeman, that record was 84 was much more produced by Eddie and Ted Templeman's longtime engineer Don Landy. He was clearly moving away from Ted Templeman. But what I'm slowly getting at is, so March of 86, 5150 comes out. At that point, you know, Van Halen recorded faster, I'm assuming, right? Who knows? They could have been both in this. I haven't gone back and looked to see if they were. Well, I know this, but actually, 5150 was all recorded at 5150 at Eddie's studio. Eat 'Em and Smile was recorded in about two or three different studios between LA and New York. But, you know, you're a Warner Brothers executive. You have both masters coming in almost simultaneously, I bet, because March 5150 comes out. And right before that is Why Can't This Be Love? It goes to number one. I can totally remember at that point there was already divided into camps, getting in arguments with my friend, with buddy of mine who loved Van Halen and was said, well, Jump never went to number one, but Why Can't This Be Love went to number one. And I'd have to double check that. I don't think it did. I know 1984 never did you know what? 1984 did not become a number one album because, Michael Jackson's album, kept it out of the top of the charts. 5150, I think, did go number one. And of course, we could look this all up on the computer machine, but, you know.
I think Jump did go number one. The album didn't.
Your career. And, yeah, I'm pretty sure of that too.
And then you get your people who like to point out the statistics of, well, Sammy Hagar sold more records with the band. And then people go, well, no, but Dave had more charting singles with the band. And people go, well, no, look at the European charts. I don't know what the answer is, besides you had two different guys who did great things in totally different ways, who I still both listen to.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I can remember at that time, I mean, I liked 5150. I, to this day, did not like the drum sound. You know, it was nowhere near as aggressive sounding as 1984, which it just did it to me. I liked Sammy before that. And certainly they were doing things in a more poppier, you know, different key direction because of Sammy's ability versus Dave's. I liked the record. But then a few months later comes June, comes Yankee Rose hits the airwaves, and I just lost my mind.
Because I will never get sick of Yankee Rose personally. No matter what, it is an original song. The spoken guitar lick thing at the beginning, I will never stop doing that to my wife and annoying her. What a statement of a solo single.
Darren, I was just going to say it made a huge statement, because if you're, because here you are, you're a Roth fan like we are, and you're going, oh my God, Van Halen sucked all the musical oxygen out of everything, and this record's huge, and sure, it's a good record, and I like 5150, and you know, and the Why Can't This Be Love is undeniably a great song with a great hook. Yeah. There's some good stuff on there, but it wasn't to, at this point, then I'm already a huge Dave fan for all the reasons we listed. My allegiance, there's a loyalty there that you had at the age of 17 years old, I think. And again, it's divided into camps, and you're like, well, what's Dave going to do? You know, there's no leaks at the time. There's no internet. You don't know what's going on. You know who's in the band. And all of a sudden, just that opening hits. And right away from the very sound, it didn't sound like a Van Halen record. But Templeman's got a way of just the way he records, he basically records live. And that thing just jumped off out of the speakers to me, and still does, whether you're listening on Spotify or the vinyl or CD, which 5150 never did for me. There's just an energy and a rhythm to it, which is, and I will debate this and we'll talk about this in additional episodes, but that's what Dave always brought, this rhythm and blues, this rhythm, this aggression, this soulfulness, all wrapped up into this musical package. And you felt that the moment Yankee Rose came driving out of the speakers.
Yeah. And it's only, I'd say, one of three or four songs like that on the album. You could say Going Crazy is kind of like the cousin of Yankee Rose in a way. Shy Boy is more of like a punk rock kind of thing. But this album is all over the place. And that's, in my opinion, I think that's a great thing. Do you think that's a great thing? I don't think it's your favorite Roth album.
You know, it was. Here's the funny thing. It's very often close to my favorite Roth album. It's one of these things where the first five or six years, the first two or three years, I listened to that record so much. If I had to look back and look back on what I've listened to since then, more as far as Dave stuff, I probably listen to Skyscraper more, A Little Ain't Enough more, the DLR band, because I'm always the guy who likes to hear where people's career goes. But a couple times a year, I'll go back into Eat 'Em and Smile. And to me, it's only 30 minutes long. It's 10 songs. Three of them are covers. But for me, from the sequencing to the sound to the songs themselves, it's a perfect record. It's a perfect rock record. Nothing ever lets up, yet it doesn't bludgeon you either.
That's a fair assessment right there. Perfect rock record, even if it's not your favorite Roth record or your second or third favorite Roth record, you put it on and you go, it's a half hour blitz of just charisma. And people don't usually hold EPs up in high regard compared to studio albums. They get shortchanged because they can go, oh, well, anyone can have two or three good songs. And I think that Eat 'Em and Smile is, again, a great, great statement. It has a little bit of the Van Halen flavor, but at the same time, you listen to it and you go, this is clearly where all the personality in Van Halen came from. Hey, I love Van Halen, one of my favorite bands ever, but what does Alex Van Halen's voice sound like? What's his speaking voice sound like?
Right, right.
And Michael Anthony, hey, few backing vocalists sound as great to me as Michael Anthony. As David Lee Roth often says, the Van Halen backing vocals are similar or comparable to the Beach Boys harmonies, that you hear those vocals and you go, that's Van Halen. Big, big characteristic. But what does Michael Anthony's speaking voice sound like? And Eddie Van Halen's voice, I guess you'd really have to think. So when you don't know what these people's speaking voices sound like, and it's not their lyrics, obviously all the personality came from Dave in this band.
Yeah, yeah. And that sounds like it's not necessarily to denigrate the other guys. It's just what was it more identifies to me and kind of and makes super visible just what the contributions were and just how that all kind of came together in the mix of it all. Right. I mean, if you go back, and again, I keep saying this because there's so many ideas for other episodes, but when you go back and read, Greg Renoff's biography of Van Halen in the early years, I think it was, I mean, you can make the argument, and he did successfully, that without Dave, Van Halen, those guys probably, you know, you'd be wondering, whatever happened to that cool prog rock band that did Rush and Led Zeppelin covers in those backyard parties that they quit around 1978? Because right. I'm telling you, there's no way that band would do Earth, Wind & Fire covers and cut their teeth, or ZZ Top covers, or cut their teeth on all the stuff they did as cover versions, cut their teeth on those backyard parties and what they did that later influenced music. There's no way they did any of that stuff with Dave. Dave brought the absolute soul to that band.
Yeah.
And that shows Needham & Smile.
I can't say that enough. I can't I can't agree with you more than that, because the magic of Van Halen 1 is not just that it's talented people, but it's that youthful energy that's there. And there was just so much to prove. And it's kind of like, well, this is our one shot. Now, granted, in those days, you could have two or three albums on a major label that's stiff, and you still wouldn't be dropped. I think Billy Joel was his fifth or sixth album that it really took off on. Right. And nowadays, oh, your first single flopped? Okay, let's work on your release from the label. So there was just so much to prove from these guys. And whether or not there was chemicals involved, I can't believe that most of Van Halen 1 was first take or like live in the studio. I think Ain't Talking About Love had some guitar overdubs, but pretty much live in the studio. And as you said before, Ted Templeman, known for being big on live in the studio kind of stuff. And a lot of this album, even though it's layered, sounds like it's live.
It really does. Again, it goes back to that energy that I don't think you lay a lot of that at the feet of Ted Templeman, certainly. But I think you definitely, that energy is Dave and Sheehan and Vi and Greg Bissonette, because right at the same time, you've got 5150, which people call it more radio friendly now. And it, sure, from a sound time, you know, as far as for the sound of it, especially for its times, it was more radio friendly. Yeah. But to me, it just didn't have that in your face energy. And there's a difference between going full blast and super loud and bludgeoning you with it, as opposed to just having this upbeat, danceable energy. And again, that soul to it. But behind all that is this incredible musicianship with the three of those guys back there, because the pedigree and what these guys could do. I mean, I can remember the argument whether Vi was better than Sheehan, Vi was better than Eddie or, you know, certainly Sheehan was better than Michael Anthony. And you can argue the merits that, you know, of who was better technically. On a side note though, what blew me, one of the things that blew me away straight away on this album, particularly hearing Shy Boy, was going, holy shit, Billy Sheehan is doing with the bass guitar what Eddie Van Halen does. He's tapping, he's doing all this stuff. To me, this was, I mean, I never heard of a bass player play like that ever before. And I knew who Sheehan was from the magazines, but I didn't know Talas. I didn't really know. I had no idea how great this guy was.
Right. You weren't from Buffalo. That's what I hear. Like Talas was an arena band in Buffalo, right. And any band that was coming through town, Talas was on the bill. And that's how Van Halen knew of him, and there's rumors that he was asked to maybe replace Michael Anthony in Van Halen, but that didn't happen for one reason or another. I actually had the pleasure of seeing in New York City, I'm going to say about 10 years ago, Billy Sheehan do a bass clinic in Times Square at a Sam Ash. And after watching that, I am just amazed and devoted about who he is and his warm attitude and how prolific he is and how he never stopped doing anything. Because let's see, Mr. Big's commercial peak in the States was what, 90, 91?
Somewhere around there with To Be With You, yeah.
Yeah, of course, in Asia, they continue to be an arena band when they do stuff. But he had Talas, David Lee Roth, Mr. Big, I think Niacin was one of his side projects.
Yeah.
All these solo albums. I think he was on some Steve Vai kind of stuff.
Yeah.
He's got the Winery Dogs with Richie Kotzen and Mike Portnoy.
Incredible band.
He's got that band with Bumblefoot. The name of it escapes me right now, but it's another one of these.
Sons of Apollo.
Sons of Apollo. This is a guy that never stopped working. Steve Vai, obviously a guy that never stopped working. Is his label Music for Nations?
I think it was. Certainly those first albums were Flexible and Passion and Warfare, I think it was. Some of those, his first solo records, particularly his first solo record, I think post Whitesnake after David Lee Roth. And yeah, I think you're right.
Well, you just said the magic word there, Whitesnake. So you got a guy, Zappa, Whitesnake, Roth.
Alcatraz.
Alcatraz. Yeah. Didn't Yngwie replace him in Alcatraz, or did he replace Yngwie?
I think he replaced Yngwie. Pretty sure of that. Yeah.
And then you go through Bissonette's credits. Bissonette, offhand, I know he's more of a session guy. I remember he played on that Pat Boone in the Metal Mood album. Do you remember that one?
Oh, God, yes.
I had the pleasure of interviewing Pat twice, like a year or two ago. And I remember him, I got him to open up about the album. He's like, and Greg Bissonette, great drummer. I think the key is, like, is there a better backing band than this Eat 'Em and Smile band? And I say that because not just the songs are great and they can shred, but they span genres on this album. How many bands can do all those genres besides them and the Roots?
that brings up a really good point about this album is that, you know, I remember reading people, and I remember at the time thinking, wow, it is kind of short. But again, it's the perfect length for what this is. It's 10 songs. You're making a statement. And I got two schools of thought here, and I hope I don't forget one of them. But I was going to mention the track list here. To me, there's no filler, and somebody go, well, there's three covers. That's filler. It's like, no way. I'm Easy is the perfect next chapter if you dig, and I did too, dig Crazy from the Heat, right? The bebop, the fun poppy lounge singer stuff, you know. Tobacco Road, that's a hard rock blues cut. That song, that was a single off the album. That's just absolutely blows me away. And then what a great way to close the record. In That's Life. I mean, that's a signature song for Dave.
I'm with you. I do not hate covers albums. Now, I did not love the Diamond Dave cover album from like 2004 or something like that. That's a whole different episode, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think that some artists, their cover choices, it's almost a work of art where they're kind of curators. And before Dave did Just a Gigolo, that was a dead Vegas standard. That was just old people music. And when you hear somebody like Dave do that, you go, not only did he reinvent this song, but he made it super cool. And wow, maybe I should listen to more music like this. That's how I feel about his covers and Van Halen's covers.
Oh, totally, completely. I mean, from You're No Good off Van Halen 2, I mean, prior to that, what was it? I only knew it as a Linda Ronstadt song.
Yeah.
And my God, it's just a whole different animal with Van Halen doing it. And so the covers, I love the covers. And Dave, and that's always been an easy shot for the critics to make. Oh, you know, they did too many covers in Van Halen, or he did. That's what's always made it fun. And it's just him. Again, one of the many things I admire about the guy, it's him chasing that muse and staying creative. This is the shit I love, and I'm gonna see how I do with it.
Yeah, and I'm sure we're going to have episodes where we talk about infamous Dave interviews. And when you get him to talk about his influences, it's very interesting to hear that he thinks of himself as a soul performer and that R&B is what really interested in him. And he's talked about in his book and other stuff about how he played the saxophone and you had to learn a little bit of each instrument as part of his community college studies and things like that. He's not this hard rocker guy. I mean, that 2008 tour, or was it the 2010 tour, whichever one it was, they brought a Kool and the Gang as the opening act. He put his foot down and went, these guys blew me away at this UK festival. This is our opening act. And the more you think about that, the more you realize that he was just doing soul music loud with flashy guitars.
Yeah. Exactly. Again, it goes back to the soul that he brought, that danceability that he brought to Van Halen and on most of his solo stuff. So I was thinking back at this time frame again, and I keep getting into it because it's always amazing to me how artists create, and just especially when they're under pressure, right? So yeah. And it's not hindsight's 2020, but certainly nobody expected a dud from Eddie Van Halen. He's too damn good of a guitar player. You know, unless it was a completely instrumental record, or unless you got somebody that was just did not mesh vocally at all with him, you knew it was going to be a fairly good record. I mean, whether the stuff came from the vaults, however they put it together, and there's debate on how much him and Hagar wrote together in the beginning, how much stuff is recycled. And so much of Eddie Van Halen's output is really from, you know, basically from 1976 to about 1984. I mean, there's so much stuff in the vaults there. I mean, the last Van Halen record, A Different Kind of Truth, most of that was stuff that they reworked from the vaults, right? So many songs through the first six albums came out of those initial tapes, those initial demo tapes that Gene Simmons produced.
Yeah, isn't the song House of Pain, sorry to cut you off there, isn't House of Pain, which is on 84, from the Gene Simmons demo?
I'm pretty sure you're right. Yeah, I mean, all told, there was about, 18 songs or something like that, and that was a good portion of the first four or five Van Halen records. But what I'm getting at is that, you know, everybody expected – Conversely, everybody expected great things from Eddie Van Halen, so many rock cognoscenti, so many people expected or even rooted for Dave to fall, you know, for whatever he was going to do to fall apart. The movie collapses. That always seemed like just a weird thing anyway. I mean, that always sounded like something that was doomed for box office failure. And I'm as big a Dave fan as anyone, but hence this podcast.
Yeah.
But, you know, the pressure that must have been for him to follow up, because he certainly, you know, certainly didn't shy away from the press at all. And there was such the war of words, and there was such the feud going on. The pressure to deliver such a great record and to deliver a great band had to have been immense. And he did it. And that's not hindsight. You knew that the moment you heard Yankee Rose when it hit the airwaves in June, and then followed barely a month later by the full record coming out on July 7th, 1986.
Steve, again, couldn't have said it any better than you just did. And Dave, okay, what you just said about Eddie, where we don't really know about the output. Did it all get written before 85 and repurposed? Is there this huge vault? We don't know. I think we can actually say the same thing about Dave, because if you just hear him talk in any interview for an hour or two, there's so many damn ideas that come out of his mouth, some of them amazing, some of them less than amazing. But we're talking about a guy who speaks at least four languages, obviously English. He cut this album in Spanish, Eat 'em and Smile, Sonrisa Salvaje.
Yeah.
I listened to that one more than the English. personally, I've heard him speak Portuguese. he cut that short film in the Japanese language, and I know he's lived in Japan. Okay, so we got a guy.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, we've got a guy who speaks at least four languages, who knows a few martial arts, who's still in shape. He can noodle around on the guitar. You know, it's debatable as to how much guitar he plays, but I'm sure he does play a little bit of everything. He's got to be going on full cylinder at all times. He never got married. He never got kids. I just can't imagine the backlog of ideas that he has that have never come out.
Right. Yeah, there's so much out there. I mean, there's so much that we don't know about, but yeah, there's, let alone what's in his head, but stuff that, you know, has filled notebooks and demo tapes. But in this particular case, when I got to thinking about this more, in the compressed time frame, the pressure that he's under, a movie falls apart, he goes in the studio, he gets his band together, because all this stuff, none of this stuff comes from the vaults, Eat 'Em and Smile. So there's 10 songs on the record. Three of them are covers. One of them, Shy Boy, is solely credited to Billy Sheehan, if I recall correctly. The rest are all Roth and Vai, which means they wrote this basically in a 3 or 4 month period and then recorded it. So you're putting together something like Ladies Night in Buffalo, Yankee Rose, all these great, you know, six amazing songs. And I don't think there's a bad song on, there's no, I said it before, there's no filler on this record. But outside the covers, talk about being able to perform under pressure and not, there's no power ballad on here. There's no chasing trends on this record, man. You know what I mean? This is where I'm at right now. I'm going to grab this by the throat and we're going to kill. And I love that attitude and just being able to, you know, perform under pressure, like I said.
Yeah, a lot of people from his era who went solo, they had to hide behind things a little bit or remind people like, hey, I'm that guy from blank. The first two Ozzy albums, he didn't write most of that. Of course, you know, ASCAP or BMI will say differently, but
same with Sharon Osbourne.
yeah, but you know, Kerslake and Daisley kind of were Ozzy Osbourne. I hope I don't get sued for libel. but, you know, read their books and they talk about that kind of stuff. So after a while, you kind of go, well, who is Ozzy? And the answer is whoever's playing guitar for him or bass is Ozzy, because they contribute to the lyrics and the music. And it's debatable as to who Ozzy is. But with this album, there's The lyrics and the vocals are still Dave. It is Dave. There's nothing but Dave, vocally and lyrically. He didn't change, and it became clear that he is this guy, and he continued with this original vision. And again, how many people, after they leave their hit band, do they go towards the trends? Do they go towards that power ballad? And has Dave really ever done a ballad? I'm not asking that rhetorically. I'm asking here, has he ever done a power ballad?
Not in the traditional sense. I mean, I guess you can call maybe something like Damn Good off Skyscraper a ballad, but that's only just because I'm trying to think of an answer right
it's
now.
It's a slower tempo.
10 minutes ago, I wouldn't have called it a ballad. You know, I mean, slower tempo song, but certainly never. I mean, the closest thing to a power ballad was, I would suppose, maybe that Alanna Miles ripoff. Hate to say it, but it's true. Tell the Truth from the A Little Ain't Enough record. But no, you're right. Yeah. He's never really done. Again, he never followed the trends. And neither did Van Halen, mind you. They were always a cut above everything else in the heavy metal scene at that time.
He also didn't strange into weird co-write land, as far as I know. So he avoided that one. There's no Desmond Child, Dave collaborations that I'm aware of.
No, you're absolutely right. No, you know, there's nothing with Diane Warren or Holly Knight or any of those folks. He kept it internal and kept it to the people he was working with.
And the trifecta of all that, there's also no All Hell's Breaking Loose Kiss style rap conversion on that end attempt. Because I love Kiss, you love Kiss, but they tried to do the disco thing, they tried to do the hip-hop thing, and then they worked with the Flavor of the Month songwriters over and over again.
Yeah, there's never been a trend that Kiss did not outwardly, without even trying to hide it, go and chase. I mean, I hate to say it, but it's true.
Yeah.
But Dave, that's never been the case with him. And looking back on the writing of this record, and I'm sure you've read this too, I mean, and with other people Dave's worked with, I mean, but when I've read interviews with Steve Vai and other people involved in this record and people he's written songs with, I mean, first off, this record was basically all jammed and written in Dave's basement in Pasadena. There was no, you know, highfalutin studio. It's a bunch of beers, garage style, the way rock bands have done it for decades. And we're gonna hash this out and do it in the basement and have fun doing it. And I remember reading an interview, I'm pretty sure it was with Steve Vai, and I'm going to paraphrase a bit here, but he said, yeah, you know, Dave would occasionally go upstairs and we would be hashing that song out. He'd come back down and he would take this one thing that he heard, go back to this. All right, play this back, play that a little bit slower, go back. And then he would have a melody. So he, for a guy who's not a quote unquote musician, he's a musician, bar none, he's a musician, right? But he was involved, to the best of my knowledge, these songs weren't worked out 95%. And, you know, he's not writing Steve solo, let's say, or Billy solo, but I guarantee you he's humming what he's hearing in his head, or he's working with these guys going, here's the melody I hear, here's where this is going, stop here, start here, speed this up here, come in here. And they've all said that thing. They, you know, he's, there was no outside writers because there didn't need to be. He was, you know, he was a huge part of the creative process in all this.
Yeah, I can think of a hair band without naming names that I worked with as a management assistant. And the way it'd work is that the guitarist, bassist, drummer, and keyboardist would basically write it, and they'd give an instrumental track to the singer, and then he'd listen to it and go, okay, here it is. And then you look at the publishing credits, and it's like 50-50 guitarist and vocalist, but they weren't writing in the room at all. But as we've talked about, this sounds like a band. It sounds like a band. It's credited pretty much as a band. And that's one of the reasons why I think it stands the test of time. This doesn't sound like, I don't know who I could throw under the bus and not feel guilty about it. So I'll just say, it doesn't sound like Star Guy has a band. The band just shows up when they're told to, and that's it. This sounds like a band, and filler-free, 30 minutes of great music. Not our favorite Roth album, but one of them.
Oh, absolutely. Right up there. Totally. Yeah. We could talk more about this album, and I think we will. I think a future episode, we need to break down the songs and the performances, and certainly as he proved that what went on record could be readily reproduced live, because the tour was fantastic.
I wish I were there, but for now, YouTube videos will have to suffice of the great Roth tours. And believe me, there's more of that on YouTube than Van Halen live shows.
Yeah, well, that will certainly be of a future episode talking about the live shows, because I went to two of them on that tour. Wow. And well, I won't give it away at all, but first time Hartford Civic Center, 10th row. And I just said, all right, here's the quick anecdote there. And then we should wrap it up. And I want to get to sure, a couple other things as we wrap it up and tell people where they can find us and all, and what's going to lie ahead on this. But 10th row, I've never, the lighting rig was the biggest thing I'd ever seen, was the biggest thing up to that time before. I couldn't believe it. Third song, and if I remember correctly, is Panama. The place, everybody completely loses their shit. Sold out arena, no filler, it's complete. The place wasn't paper, it sold out. It's October of 86. Third song is Panama. Sometime in the middle of Panama, Dave goes, and at the time, you don't know it's rehearsed, it's been done, of course, you don't know what happens every night, but that's, everybody knows how bands work, you know, and this massive lighting rig, and Dave's like, wait, stop. Little pause for dramatic effect. He's looking at all of us, you know, got that big grin on his face. What do you think of the new band so far? And just everybody lost their mind. It was just Panama. And then just goes back. And we just, I mean, my buddies and I, we had like tears of joy, like stuffed in the aisle at the Hartford Civic Center. It was just, yeah, this is now the greatest show we've ever seen in our lives. And to this day, it's right up there for me.
I believe it. I'm glad that wasn't one of the stories of he stops it and then goes, I forgot the fucking words. And then, you know, only 20% of the audience realizes that he says that every night and has for decades, as opposed to him not being prepared.
Exactly.
That went better than I would have expected.
Exactly. And I can tell you, I don't remember at all the I forgot the fucking words bit being thrown, at least the shows that I saw. I don't recall that happening at all. So
you got to look at all the people here tonight.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I would be disappointed if I didn't hear that.
Agreed, Steve. Well, hey, I'm going to look for that show on YouTube later.
All right. Well, Darren, our first episode is in the can here. A couple things. By the time this gets out there, we will have a much better website at thedlrcast.com, where eventually I think you'll see photos. You'll see some different things. I love the idea of we'll have an email address coming up where I'd love to have people send in their own photos and who knows, recollections, maybe some blog posts up there as this hopefully keeps growing. We've got a bevy of episode ideas I think we can get into here at the DLR cast. But first, Darren, tell everyone where folks can find you and your work.
Oh, thanks, Steve. The podcast comes out every other Wednesday. It's called The Paltrowcast with Darren Paltrowitz. You can find it through V13 Media, iTunes, Spotify, you name it. Still writing articles, around 10 a week for different publications, so some of those wind up on the podcast. And in general, www.paltrowitz.com will lead you to my books, two of which on Amazon. Take it away, Steve.
I love it. All right. Well, again, you'll find us at thedlrcast.com. I have a podcast myself talking about music and God knows what else called The Weapon of Self-Distraction. And till the next time, we'll be cranking. I'm going to be cranking Eat 'Em and Smile right after this. Now, do I put on the vinyl, the CD? I have, or just go straight to Spotify? That's the dilemma nowadays.
Well, at least a fraction of a penny goes to him if you do Spotify. So
that's true. All right. Darren, till the next time, my friend.
Thanks, Steve.
All right.